My name is Deborah Pacheco, and I'm an alcoholic. Am I standing for? I'm very glad to be here. I'm really grateful to be sober. I want to thank Larry for inviting me to share. Anybody that doesn't like my pitch, Larry. Raise your hand, Larry. See Larry about it. I don't want to hear it. See Larry. I want to thank Christine and the other three or four people, it seemed like, that were sending me emails to help Larry, who's technically, you know, challenged just a little bit. You know. I want to thank him. I want to also thank my friend Linda, you know, for being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I called up at the last minute and said, Linda, will you drive with me? And she says yes. What a good example of the program that is for me to see. Because I'm sure somebody's going to call me up and I'm going to say, I don't really want to go in my mind, but I'm going to have that example. Yes. You know, and just do it. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. You know, we're glad that you're here. We hope that you stay. Yeah. And I hope that you found what I found here. And that is how to, you know, be reasonably comfortable and stay sober one day at a time. You know, I have a sobriety date. It's April the 19th, 2000. I have a home group. It is the Bellflower Big Book Group, and I have a sponsor, and I'm current with her. She's the lovely Marianne F. And, you know, I'm really grateful, you know, for those things. However, Larry invited me out here to share with you what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. You know, I grew up in Louisiana. You can kind of hear that. I just got back from, you know, Louisiana. You're going to hear that kind of southern thing. I might say down, yeah, no, there, hey, y'all, you know, whatever. You know, just go with it. You know, work with it. So I grew up in Louisiana, and I grew up, let me thank Mike. Thank you, Mike, you know, for sharing your experience with us. Anyway, I grew up in Louisiana, my home group is a large group like this group, and I sit right in the middle of the group, and I know this is a program of identification, but I'm alcoholic, so I'm just going to be honest about it. People are standing at the podium, and they're saying stuff to me like, they got sober when they were six, and they had their first drink at seven, and they did this at nine, and I'm sitting there saying, if that would have happened to me, I would not have to had to worry about being an alcoholic, because my dad would have killed me. That's just what I'm thinking, you know. So, I mean, no offense to you people that start drinking at 5 and 7. You know, I'm just saying what would have happened to me. Anyway, I grew up in Louisiana, and I grew up in this in my family, and there were 8 siblings, you know, and we grew up poor. Now, I have a sister, and she's older. You know how you have one in every family. I have one in mine. She's kind of bougie, you know, and you guys tape stuff, and she heard me tell you guys we were poor, and that just she was totally devastated. How dare you? Sort of like Mike. You don't tell people we weren't poor. We were poverty stricken. I think the girl's playing on words. You know, when I say that, you know, that we were poor, man, I would come running home from school. And in my house, there were no light switches. You know, we had strings. You kind of pull this, and you pull that little string, and no lights would come on. And then you would look, and you would see the extension cord, and it's going out to the neighbor's houses, you know. Or you turn on the water, and the water wouldn't come on, you know. So it was basically, you know, that type of, you know, living existence. And I grew up during the era of Barbie doll. We in San Diego, right? I don't know if you guys have a fair. Maybe you guys have went to the Orange County Fair. It's not that long of a commute. Anyway, I grew up in the era of Barbie dolls, and it's 8 of us, and, you know, I tell you, we were little poverty-stricken, you know, so Coca-Cola, some of you guys may remember, Coca-Cola used to come in a bottle, and the bottle was made of glass, and it had sort of like a little shape, you know, like a little shape, so what I would do is I would play with the Coca-Cola bottle, and going back to the fair thing, believe it or not, corn comes on a cob, you know, and if at the end of the cob is some silky kind of stuff, and you could break that off, and you could put the corn cob inside of the Coca-Cola bottle and get some scrap material. You played, too, I can tell, you know, and get some scrap material and make yourself a doll. Now, this lady over here, she's looking at me, and she's like, oh, you know, here's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I now own Barbie. I got Barbie black. I got Barbie white. I got Barbie Puerto Rican, you know. This program does work. You know, actually, you know, so that's the way I grew up, you know. And I'm one of those kids that I really lived up to my potential, you know. I talked about people come to the podium and they say, you know, when they start drinking, I don't really know. You know, I don't really know. But, you know, this is, you know, for the sake of my story, I'm going to say I took my first drink around 15 years old. Now, when I walked into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, mainly when I started reading the book with my sponsor, they got, in the doctor's opinion, they're saying men and women drink for the effect that is produced by alcohol. And I'm like, whoa, what effect did it produce on me? Because trust me, I did not get drunk. And because I wouldn't be standing here right now if I got drunk. But so the only effect that alcohol did, you know, gave me when I first started drinking was I just felt like I was a part of the group. My friends were drinking. I'm drinking because they drink it. But I'm doing some serious control drinking because I can't go home drunk. I'm not going to be found in the neighbor's yard in the morning. So that was the effect. You know, at 16 years old, I was one of those kids. I lived up to my potential. I found myself at a university in Louisiana. You know, no one had explained anything to me. You know, I had never gone anywhere. I'm from a little small town. You know, my parents had not set me down and told me the facts of life. You know, and at 16 years old, I find myself pregnant. Now, when I grew up in those days, you know, this is not something you can hide for a very long time. Sooner or later, somebody's going to figure it out. So I remember, you know, telling my dad, and he says that I was going to get married because that's what they did back then. You know, I'm kind of dating myself, but I know I look good for my age. Don't worry about it. Anyway, you know, I remember telling him, and I remember him saying, you know, that I was going to get married. And I distinctly remember saying to him, no, that's not what I want to do. So after the wedding, I have a husband. I have a husband I don't want. And now I got a kid I don't really want, you know. And, you know, my mother, you know, she, you know, I had my son, and my mother, she kept him for me to finish, you know, college. And I had this husband, you know, and he was in the Army, and he gets out the Army, and he has an aunt that lives here in California, and we have a plan. He's going to move. We're going to move to California. I'm going to work on this advanced degree, and we're going to take care of our little family. And that's what we did. And we came to California, and he's working. I get a little part-time job, and I'm in school, and life is wonderful. Now, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I cannot call anyone an alcoholic. You know, but I'm the speaker tonight, so this is my story. I meet up with this man, you know. This man is my boss, and this is my story. And this guy was a heavy, 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 heavy drinker. You know, and he was the type of boss that we could drink our lunch. You know, when I opened the book and I read Bill's story, Bill talks about talking. Am I talking too loud to this thing? Okay. Bill talks about talking. Okay, by the way, if you're new, where are the books at? Any books back there? Okay, I would check anything I say that's in the book. No, I don't need the book. Show them the book. Yeah. Anything that I'm saying to you that I say is in the book, you need to go check it out in that book and find it for yourself. Because how do you know I'm telling you the truth? Read the book. Anyway, Bill talks about talking in thousands and chattering in millions. You know, and this guy, you know, with, you know, my boss, that's the way it was. We would be at happy hour, we'd be at Bobby McGee and Quiet Cannon, you know. I'm like shopping in Manhattan Beach, you know. I felt like I had arrived, you know. Life was just wonderful, you know. But something deep, deep, deep inside of me, something was a little bit off. Now, I only know this in hindsight and after taking inventory. When this was happening, this was not what I'm thinking. You know, I'm thinking I'm having a good time. So something like inside of me was messed up. And you know what? You know, I realized, you know what the problem is? The problem is really him, you know, because I didn't want to marry him no way, you know. And then, you know what? I make $2 more than he make anyway, so I really don't need him. And when I did inventory, I realized that he was the first thing that I sacrificed for my drinking. I'm going to tell you guys, standing here, you know, tonight, 12 years later, it's nothing wrong with him. There wasn't anything wrong with him then. The problem was me, but you could not have told me that. So he was the type of, he was the first thing, you know, that I sacrificed. You know, I am the type of, I have this kid and, you know, I'm drinking now and I'm doing some other things that are outside issues. And I have this kid, this 16-year-old kid. And this is a part of my story I'm not proud of, but this is just what it is. You know, and I remember I come home one day and this kid was packed. I said, come home. I don't know where I was coming from. But anyway, he was packing his clothes and told me he was going to live with his aunt. Now, any good mother would have known that something was wrong. You know, I did not connect the dots. Here's the keen alcoholic mind. This kid leaves, you know, I didn't try to stop him, you know. This kid leaves, keen alcoholic mind, say, you know what? Why you have to pay rent? Wherever you lay your hat can become your home, you know? To make my story short, this whole drunkalogue, this is the type of alcoholic woman I am. When I started on this road into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, in which I didn't know that's where I was going, I had a condominium in Cerritos. I went from a condominium in Cerritos to a cardboard box in the junkyard. I am the type of alcoholic woman. I will sell me. I will sell you. You know? When I opened the book and I read the words incomprehensible demoralization, I didn't need my sponsor to tell me what they were talking about. I knew exactly what that meant. I had lived it. A lot of you guys, a lot of people, and I believe you when you stand at the podium and you say to me, you are sick and tired of being sick and tired, that you could not do it another day. You know, that alcohol will stop working for you. I believe you guys when you say that to me. However, that is not my story. Alcohol never stopped working for me. The book talks about, you know, not being able to differentiate the truth from the false, that your alcoholic life had become normal. That is my experience, you know. What happened was I didn't wake up and say, ooh, something is wrong, let me go to AA. But when you were living, when you're living like I was living, and you're doing the type of things that I was doing, you know, society frowns upon you. And on this particular day, the Harvard police picked me up and took me to jail. Same way I felt about it. You know, and it wasn't my very first time to go to jail. Hopefully, it will be my last time going to jail. But what happened for me was, as a matter of fact, when I got to jail, I realized all my friends were in jail. You know? It was like, hey, girl, thought you were dead. How you doing? You know, I was like, you know, I had gone to jail before, and I know none of you guys, you know, in San Diego have ever gone to jail. But, you know, I've gone to jail before, but I hadn't been in a little while. And my experience was Civil Brand Mariloma, you know, where you can go roaming around like a little vacation place. But they had built these things called Twin Towers, and they were locking you up. So that was a new experience for me. You know, so I'm like, and then they locked me up in a pod that my friends were in the other pod. So I'm locked up in the Twin Towers. And I had an obsession. This obsession had kicked in. Then I didn't know anything. All I know was I'm waking up in the middle of the night thinking about my friend Cisco, you know. I'm looking around on the floor for stuff, you know. I'm like, you know, have these nice sweats, and I just really don't know what's going on, you know. And I remember, I don't know where the thought came from, and I remember I got down, you know, the thought came to me to get down on my knees and ask God for help. Now, you guys take this thing. My dad, the deacon, you know, he heard me say, I got down on my knees and asked God for help. He says, Deborah, well, really he calls me, and don't no one call me this after I said, Deborah, cut it. Don't think you're going to say it. Anyway, he says, haven't you ever asked God for help before? And in all honesty, I had. I had said, God, please don't let this man kill me. God, please let the liquor store be open. God, please let this be good stuff. But I had never humbly asked God for help. And I remember I slept on the top bunk, and I remember jumping in the top bunk after saying that prayer. And when I woke up the next morning, it was clear to me that I had slept soundly. So I began to pray. Yeah. The next thing that happened, these are all coincidence. I am not really putting this whole spiritual God thing with it. But the next thing that happened to me over the intercom while I'm in jail comes an announcement about a H&I AA panel. I don't know what H&I is, and I don't know what AA is, but they're going to let you out of this cell and let you go in the common area. That is the reason I go. For everybody that's in here that's new, I'm going to tell you something. You don't have to have good motives to stay sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Your motives don't have to be good at all, but you have to have a willingness to follow the examples and the direction. You don't have to have good motives, because I didn't. So I go to this H&I AA panel just to speak to my friend. You know, we've passed little notes through the crooks of the door. We got it all lined up. We're sitting back on death row back there. There's this woman, she's up front, you know, because we're doing everybody's inventory. That's what you do when you're back there. We're doing everyone's inventory. And there was this woman, and she was my first example of the program. Her name was Jazz. And Jazz was standing at the front of the room, pretty much like I am. And Jazz had the prettiest white teeth. Her skin was chocolate brown. Her hair was like silk. And Jazz was standing up at the front of the room trying to tell me she didn't drink. So I assessed the situation. I'm looking at her. I'm like, she's cute. She's kind of young. She don't drink. She got to be smoking some good weed. In my mind, I could not fathom, why would somebody not drink? She's pretty. She's young. Who would not drink? You know? But, okay, I don't smoke weed, in case you're thinking that. Anyway, so she was my first example, you know, of the program. So I'm in jail, and, you know, things are going on. I'm beginning to pray, and over the intercom, well, before that, everybody should have a him or her or somebody in their story. I have mine. He's in prison, you know. The thing about him, though, is when he's not in prison, he has a really good job. A really good job, you know. But he's the type of guy, he really don't like for me to be self-supporting through my own contributions when he's out. You know, some of you guys missed that. Anyway, he, to get his job back, you know, he's got to go to this halfway house when he gets out. What a bummer, you know. So over the intercom comes this thing about this whole relapse prevention class, and here's your motive thing. The only reason I'm going to the relapse prevention class is because they're going to give me a book to read. I have to be in jail and need something to read. We didn't have Nooks and, you know, Kindles and all that those days. So I go there and I get my book, and they give me a list of recovery homes, and I'm talking to him, and to get his job back, you know, we decide that I'll go to a recovery home, and here's God doing more for me when I look in hindsight than I could do for myself. I have been there a little while. I know how long it takes mail to, you know, to go, and it's 3 weeks before I'm to be released. And I just write, you know, I have a lot of time. I just write recovery homes. You know, in a 3 week period of time, I mail letters and I got a response from a recovery home. And So I'm scheduled to go there when I get out, and you know, I get out, and it's on a Saturday, on a Saturday morning, and he picks me up, and we come back, you know, to this little flea bag motel, and he has to be in at 10 o'clock or something, and when he leaves, I walked out, and I look around to see where I'm at geographically, and I have a couple of dollars in my pocket, which I don't need, because I've been in jail, you know, everybody gets you started, and, you know, and I look, and I go in the liquor store, and I go to the wine, I always like to say cabinet, but it's the wine fridge, because somebody told me a natural wine has a cork in it, so I don't know anything about that. Yeah. I like to screw the cap off. But I go to the wine fridge, and I look at my friend Cisco, and I will say, what is going to be? It's going to be cherry. It's going to be strawberry. It's going to be grape. And here was God doing more for me than I could do for myself. When I left out of that liquor store, I had a brownie, a bag of chips, and a Pepsi. Yeah? And that amazes me today. But, you know, but as you can tell, it's by the skirt, I still eat it. But, so anyway, I go back to this motel, and then on that Monday, I go to this recovery home, and then Monday night they took me to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you knew, I've been really blessed. I've been sober since my very first meeting. So for those people who think you have to go back out, that has not been my experience, and I pray that I don't have to do that. You know, they take me to this meeting. It was a participation meeting, and a man shared something at this meeting that I have never read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. However, it has come true in my life. He says, you can't stop your life from getting better. I was like, what? What? It was so profound, I put it on a post-it note and carried it on. I'm at this recovery home. I do structure really well, which is probably why I like my home group. They really structure. They really AA. Some people call them Nazis. I don't want to offend anyone, but they pretty AA, like AA, you know. So, but it works really well for me because I pretty much do whatever Deborah wants to do, it as Deborah sees it, until I met these people. So it has been a good thing for me. You know, so I'm at this recovery home, and the people at this recovery home, they're actually associating my weekend pass with sponsorship. If you don't have a sponsor, you can't go on pass. What? So about 5 weeks in a row, I had somebody's name and telephone number. Never called them. Different person every week, but I'm going on pass. You know, that's just the bottom line. So I do this, and I'm turning in. I'm going on my pass. So one night, you guys on the H&I came to the recovery home because that's what you guys do. And I'm sitting on death row because that's what I'm doing, because really, I'm not really alcoholic. I'm hanging out this recovery home. This is my plan. I'm hanging out there, you know, and in 3 months, when he gets out that rehab, gets his job back, he's going to get us an apartment, and life goes on. That's my plan. That's what I went in to plan with. And I'm in this H&I thing, and you guys have come to share your experience, you know, for fun and for free. And I'm sure you said some wonderful things, but I'm not really paying attention because I'm not alcoholic. I'm just hanging out at this recovery home. And I'm sitting on death row, and the house lady comes, and she does this. Well, I already know I'm not supposed to get out of my seat. So I'm looking, my back is against the wall. I'm looking like, who is she talking to? And she keeps, and then finally I'm like, and she's telling me to come outside. And I'm like, oh, she set me up, you know. But I get up and I walk outside, and she looks at me, and she asks me a question that changed my life. She says, Deborah, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? I looked at her. This lady controls my weekend pass. That's the way I looked at her, like, okay, yes. That was my answer. She said, well, you asked that lady, and the lady was part of the panel. I'm sure she had shared something profound. I just didn't hear it. Yeah. She said, you asked that lady to be your sponsor when she comes out. I'm like, okay. The H&I panel was over. I could see the house manager standing on the porch. I could feel her in my peripheral view. And I'm looking, I'm watching, so I have to ask this lady. So I walked up to her and I say, "Will you sponsor me?" She took out a card, she wrote her name, she wrote her telephone number, she wrote, "Read the doctor's opinion." She flipped the card over, she wrote, "Call me every day." She put some squiggly marks under every, she did her hair like this and she walked off. I said to myself, "I don't even like that." Yeah, we're taping, I'm not going to say it worked. Anyway, the next day, here's God doing more for me than I could do for myself. Even today, I don't know why. You know, it's only the grace of God. I picked up the phone. I was full of fear. I don't know this lady. She don't know me. What am I going to say to her? I don't know what to do, but I pick up the phone anyway. I say, "You told me to call you." My journey into the program began. This woman would show up every weekend for fun and for free. And she showed me by her example, and she walked me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if you knew, I want to tell you something. I ain't believe nothing the woman was saying. You know, I know my ideas were better than hers, and I know I was smarter than she was. I know that. But you know what? I'm going to do what she say anyway, you know. And when this doesn't work out, I'm going to let her know, "You told me to do this. Now look what happened." Yeah. That's the theory I start working under, you know. I'm 12 years later. I have a new sponsor now. However, I've never been given a direction in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that has not enhanced my life. I have come to believe. You know, she would come and share with me, and we would talk. And over a period of time, I realized that she was the very first person that I had ever met that I knew had lived like I had lived, that I knew had done the type of things that I had done. And I could clearly see that she wasn't living or doing those type of things, you know, anymore. You know, she would say to me, "Deborah, do you think you're powerless over alcohol and that your life is unmanageable?" "Oh, well, let me see. What, I'm 44 years old in the recovery home. Maybe it's just a little bit unmanageable, just a little bit." She wanted me to come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Lots of people have a problem with God. I knew right at that point that God was working, because I'm sitting in this recovery home that is in the middle of the hood, and they let me go to the store, and I could see what's going on around me, and I have a couple of dollars, and I haven't, you know, there's no locks, no, I could just walk, what? And I'm still here. I had no problem with God. I knew that he was somewhere in the mix and was watching over me. She wanted me to come to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God as I understood him. You know, we got on our knees and we did, we got one, ran one off. Okay. You know, we got down on our knees and we did this whole third step prayer. And really at that point, I'm like, okay, I'm walking hand in hand with God, and he has me. Today, I'm under no illusion that God is in charge and that God is controlling my life today. But back then, you know, like I say, they're a pretty strict group, so they do a lot of things. They kind of plan your life in my group. They always got something for you to do with your... They don't say, "Would you like to go to the potluck?" No, you will be at the potluck. You expect... They don't give you a choice, you know. And so I'm like going... The book say, "Be quick to see what clergyman is right." So I'm going to church, and they're going to let us go. The church was sending us on a retreat in Palm Springs. The big book group was having potluck. Let's see. Church retreat in Palm Springs. Big book group potluck. Church. Oh, Palm Springs. So I go to Palm Springs. So Monday, I'm in the greeting line. I see my sponsor. Her hair is coming. You know. She's beelining right to me. And she's like, "Deborah, what happened to you yesterday?" I said, "Now listen, God told me." Now, this is a true story. God told me to go to the retreat. You know, God, Trump sponsor. Okay? Everybody agree? That's what I thought, too. She looked at me and she says, "Deborah, the next time God tells you to do something, check with me first." If you're newly sober, if you're newly sober as I was, I agree with my sponsor. Check with your sponsor first. You know, then she started talking about things like resentments. You know, she wanted me to make a list of resentments. I don't have no resentments. I'm from a dog-eat-dog world. You do me, I do you. What goes around comes around. No harm, no foul. That's just the way it is. And she says, "Well, okay. We're going to find some because everybody you're not going to kiss when they come through the door, let's write their name on the list." Yeah. And I got to about the fifth name, and I realized that I'm really ticked off at all of you guys. Let me tell you why. And I began to write, you know, and I was really blessed to get sober with a girl that she was sponsored that is sober still today. And I know she had already done her inventory. So they gave me incentive to want to do mine. And I began to do this inventory. And, you know, I'm writing and we start talking about, you know, the fears and everything. And for some of you guys that get to take forever to do it, my hat's off to you. She was pretty much a deadline person, you know, yeah, from this day to this day. And it was very important for me to make that deadline. And I remember being in the room, and she said, "Deborah, how's the inventory going?" I said, "Oh, I have 3 columns, blah, blah, blah." And she said, "Well, what about the 4th column?" "Whoa, wait a minute. I opened the book. It's 1, 2, 3. And I've been waiting to catch her in something because I know she didn't know what she was talking about. So I got her dead to the right now because it's 1, 2, 3 columns. And we walking through Big Book and seemed like everybody was looking at me, but I know I'm right. I know there's only 3 columns. I know it. So let's go to the literature table and I'm going to show you because I am right. Yeah. And we go there and we open the book and, you know, like you sponsors do, you let me have my say and you flip the page. Looking at your own mistake. Where are you at fault? It was right there in front of me in black and white. We get this down on paper. Yeah. So I was able, you know, to do that and my fears. But then I gave you a little hint about my sex life. Then she wants to talk about sex. Well, wait a minute. You know, listen, didn't you hear me? I didn't ask those people their name. What am I supposed to call them? I don't know their name. She's like, "I don't care what you call them. You can call them the corner of Avalon and D, the green truck, the cowboy boots, you know, the baseball hat. But we're going to get them down on paper." So that was really fun because I had some great names for, you know, some of the people. You know, it was really good. And then when I was ready, I read my inventory to her, and I remember we said this whole third step prayer again, and I just bust out the crying, you know. I just bust out the crying. Even before we got started, my hand was shaking, and she told me to put the paper down and just tell her the 3 things I had not wrote that. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but it's just some things I'm just not going to tell. I'm just going to die with them. You know, and right then, you know, the ice melted, and I was able to share, you know, those things with her. And then she shared some things with me, and I'm like, dang. I wasn't judging or nothing. I'm just like, whoa. You know, and when I was, you know, I remember, you know, leaving her house, and, you know, everybody have different experience on what happens in that 4th step. But for me, you know, maybe I felt a little lighter, but what I really felt is like I had earned the right to sit in my seat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's basically, you know, what is happening. And I was supposed to, the question is, I mean, I say supposed to, I was supposed to go home and sit quietly for an hour, reflecting back over those first 5 proposals. And by then, I'm all into it. So I would think of something else, and I would call her, and I would think of something, and I would call her. By the 3rd time I called her, she says, "Deborah, do you know you start the hour over every time you call me?" I'm like, whoa. So the truth of the matter is I only sat for 47 minutes. And every time we're in my Wednesday book study, we get to that part, I kind of cream. And my new sponsor has directed me to go back and sit for an hour, but I haven't gotten in enough pain yet. And I was ready. I got down on my knees, and I put the book in front of me, and I said the seven-step prayer. Now, when I was talking to my sponsor, and I'm crying, and snot is going everywhere, you know, she's kind of writing on a piece of paper backwards and forth. Thought she was being rude, because she was a little rude sometimes. But she's flipping backwards and forward, but I have this piece of paper, and now I have a list of names. By now, I figured this whole AA thing out. Those are the people she think I owe an amends to. And she put some adjectives and adverbs. You know, and I think she felt like those were my character defects. I know today she spotted them really well because she has them also, but I didn't know that then. You know, and for those of you new, do I believe my character defects have been removed? No. They're still there. They're just waiting. You know, they pop out every while, but they're really a lot better than they were 12 years ago. You know, they're really a lot better. And then she came out with... Words like restitution. Like restitution, I just got a job. She told me to call the IRS, you know, and the people that held my bank loan and tell them why I was slow to pay. I didn't think that was a good idea. They hadn't seen me in 10, 15 years. They don't even know where to look for me at. Why would I call these people up? You know? So against my better judgment, I did do that. I remember crying, I'm an alcoholic. That's like, and the lady at the IRS was so kind to me. She was so kind. She must have heard the story before. So I do this, and I'm making these payments, and the important thing is I'm making them in a timely manner. And I'm doing this, and I come home from school one day, because by now I'm back in school. I come home from school one day, and the IRS has sent me a letter, and they've returned two of my payments. Please don't think I'm not telling you to lie to your sponsor. I'm simply sharing my experience. So I open it up, and I have this check from the IRS. I thought I hit the lotto. I got so excited, I called my sponsor to share the good news. And I'm sharing the good news with her, and then she was, like, really quiet, and she says to me, you know, you have to give the money to charity. You know, to your favorite charity is her words. Give it to your favorite charity. I told her I am my favorite charity. She didn't think it was funny. The end of the phone got really quiet, you know, and that's what I did. And, I made those amends to my son, to my dad. You know, and my life, the promises began to come true just like they outlined in the book for me. You know, and Bill Wilson knew about the 10 step. Continue to take personal inventory. Look, I can do this little hour and a half with you guys. I'm going to be kind. I'm going to be sweet. If we're not getting along, I'll simply go to the other side of the room. You know, I know how to do this. But once I hit Mentor Street, practice these principles. It was a little harder, you know, and my new sponsor, she has directed me, and she's made, my husband loves her, you know, because she told me simple things like, Deborah, my husband's name is Eddie, she said, Deborah, everything Eddie says does not require a response from you. I'm like, what? You know? You know, she says, you can be happy or you can be right. Oh, my God, and, you know, she said, smile and walk into the other room. You know, and I didn't believe any of it worked, but I began to, you know, practice some of those things. And I don't have to say I'm sorry as often, you know. And because, you know, you can say you're sorry and you're sorry. Keep doing the same thing. You're really not sorry. And that's what I was doing. I'm sorry and do the same thing next day. You know, but so that, you know, has gotten a lot better. And then we went to prayer and meditation. I have no problem with prayer and meditation. You know, I couldn't even sit for the hour. My sponsor is helping me out at a sponsorship meeting. We now have to meditate. So once a month, that's progress. You know, I try. That's okay. All right. So once a month, you know, I do meditation. But in the 12 and 12, if you knew, there's a book back there. It's called the 12 and 12. You know, I'm reading this, and, one day I read it, and it says something to the effect about... You can, once you have started the practice of prayer, you can't go without it, like you can't go without air or sunshine. I read that and decided in my mind, that's not true. So I'm going to stop praying. I made an executive decision. We don't need no sponsor, you know. And I began to, I stopped praying and I wreaked havoc. I wreaked havoc at home, at work, in my home group. I destroyed some friendships that I'm not going to ever be able to repair. And my sponsor, you know, she set me down. And we, on several occasions, and we finally realized that I had stopped praying. And she told me that you can start back again. And I didn't know how to start. And she flipped the page. And there it is. Say, start, just start. So I began, you know, I began to start praying again. And my life, you know, took on a new meaning. You know, and having had this spiritual awakening, I get in the car and drive all the way to San Diego, you know, to share my experience, strength, and hope. My life is not always wonderful, you know. Things have happened. I married Mr. Him, you know. We have a wonderful home. You know, my brother, you know, he died as a direct result of this illness, you know, when I was two years sober, you know, at about... six or seven years. So my only son, you know, was shot, you know, and no, he's not dead. I got to remember to say that. He was shot, and, you know, my dad, he watches me, you know, I flew there, and he watched me go through this, you know, with my son, and he says to me, if you didn't drink right then, I think you got it made, you know. And the thought to drink never occurred to me, you know. A couple of years later, his oldest son, the love of my life, you know, 18 years old, just a great kid, you know, he just fell dead from an aneurysm, you know, and I don't know, you know, why God, you know, why these things happen, you know, in my life, you know, but they do. Myself, you know, I'm dealing with some challenges of my own, you know, but here's what I do know. I know that God is in charge and that I don't have to drink. No matter what, you know, one of the girls I sponsor, she said, you just keep going and you just don't drink. If you knew, I'm going to leave you with this. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you. If you're willing to follow some direction, here's the key, that don't make any sense. Yeah, here you go. Your life is falling apart and they want you to pick these chairs up. I don't get the correlation either, but that's what they want you to do. Your life is falling apart, and they're telling you to take the trash out. The light is on in your car, and they want you to get in your car, go pick up Mary 5 miles away, and bring Mary back to the meeting and tell you, have faith, God is going to take care of you. You know, but if you're willing, my experience is if you're willing to do some directions and some do some things that you don't believe in and make no sense whatsoever, I can promise you what the man said at my very first meeting. You can't stop your life from getting better. Thank you.